Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. I'm Vicki St. Clair, and last month I had the pleasure of talking with a wonderful writer, very talented writer, Garth Stein. He's the author of The Art of Racing in the Rain, a New York Times bestseller. And today I'm pleased to share that interview with you for the first time on Conversations Live. I can tell you that if you enjoy a good story, are fond of animals, like to laugh a lot and cry a little, you'll love his latest book. It totally transported me. Garth Stein has authored two other novels, the award-winning How Evan Broke His Head and Other Secrets, and Raven Stole the Moon. He's also written a full-length play, Brother Jones, and worked as a documentary filmmaker for several years, co-producing The Last Party, starring Robert Downey Jr. Garth teaches fiction to writers from second grade to adult and lives here in Seattle with his wife, three sons, and his dog, Comet. So let me introduce for the first time on Conversations Live, Garth Stein, author of The Art of Racing in the Rain. Welcome, Garth. Welcome to the show today. We're so pleased to have you here with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Vicki.
This is, I was telling you before the show, this is such a great book. I really, really enjoyed it. I want to ask you if you just very briefly describe it in your own words so that our listeners who aren't familiar with it can get an idea of what it's about.
Well, sure. The Art of Racing in the Rain. It's a book that's told from the point of view of a dog named Enzo. And the dog is convinced that in his next lifetime, he's going to be reincarnated as a person. And so he studies everything around him, including all the beliefs and acts of his master, who's a race car driver. And he studies everything around him so that when he returns to this world, he'll be a very good citizen. And through the process, he realizes that if you were to apply the same rules that make you successful on a racetrack, balance, anticipation, patience, you know, never worrying about things that have already happened that you can't control, but only worrying about things that are in front of you that you can control. If we were to live our daily lives like that, we'd be very good people. So he endeavors to spread that word when he returns to Earth.
He's a very wise soul. and he got this wisdom from watching National Geographic, right?
Well, he watches a lot of television. His master Denny leaves the TV on for him when he goes to work during the days. And Denny leaves it always on a different channel. So he wants Enzo to have a well-rounded education. So National Geographic, one day, weather the next day. Of course, speed and racing and cars, anything like that is a big treat for Enzo. But he also loves classic movies, too. So there are quite a few movie references in the book of things that he's seen.
Where did you get the inspiration for this, to write from a dog's point of view?
Well, the idea first came to me about 10 years ago. I used to make documentary films. And when I was still doing that in New York, someone had shown me a film that was made in Mongolia called State of Dogs, and they asked me if I would consult on the U.S. distribution of it. And it was a very fascinating film. It was about this idea that in Mongolia, among the nomadic people, there's a belief that the next incarnation for their dogs will be as a person. And so they have a certain burial rituals they undertake to release the spirit of the dog so it can roam freely until it's time to be reincarnated. And I thought, geez, what a wonderful idea. You know, I didn't get involved with the film for a number of reasons, but I just thought it's such a neat concept that we get to see our animals that we love so much, we'll get to see them again. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I kind of tucked it away in the back of my head. And then about 3 years ago, the poet Billy Collins came to town to do a reading for Seattle Arts and Lectures. And I went to see it. And he's a great poet, and I encourage everyone to seek out his poetry. He read a poem of his called The Revenant, which is words from the dead. And it's told from the point of view of a dog who's recently been euthanized, addressing his master from doggy heaven.
Oh, interesting.
And it starts like this. I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you.
Oh.
When I heard that line and the rest of the poem, a light bulb literally went on in my head, and I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell a story about a dog who's going to be reincarnated as a person, but I'm going to tell it from the dog's point of view.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear a little bit of that in just a moment. I want to ask you, you had such a strong voice for this dog. Did your dog collaborate with you on this?
You know, my dog, Comet, I love very much, and she's really very sweet, but she's not ready to be reincarnated as a person yet. I'm sorry. She's still a little too obsessed with a tennis ball. She has a few more lifetimes as a dog.
Yeah. Now, most people say that the eyes are the windows to the soul. Enzo, the dog who tells your story, says that hands are the windows to the soul. Why?
Well, he has a very specific reason for that. He watches a lot of races that his master is driving in. And when you drive in a race, semi-professional or whatnot, they have usually an in-car camera that the driver uses so he can watch the race after the fact and see, this is where I made a mistake, this is what I did, this is how I can be better next time. And in that in-car camera, you always see the dashboard. You get some of the telemetry, you know, how fast the car is going and stuff. And you see the steering wheel and the hands on it. And anybody who's done any race car driving knows that the hands are very important to a race car driver, obviously, to turn the wheel. But people who grip the wheel like the world is coming to an end tend to be very stiff drivers and not flexible, and they get themselves in trouble because they're not able to adapt quickly enough. So you always have to be relaxed and easy with your hands. Have soft hands, they say.
Mm-hmm.
So Enzo realizes that when he's watching these things that the hands of people really tell, because they are so important. And he notes it particularly because he has no thumbs. So obviously for him, he's fixated on the hands. So he develops this whole idea of hands are the windows to a man's soul.
I just love it. And the book made me laugh out loud several times. It also made me weep, as I'm sure many of your readers say that. You need a box of tissues if you're going to read this. But there's one bit where he talks about man being dominant. And he says, case in point, the werewolf. He said that man, you tell it.
Yes. He, after watching a lot of television, he believes that there is a fault with Darwin's theory of evolution. He says that, you know, everyone believes that man was evolved from the chimpanzee, but he doesn't believe that's the case at all. He actually thinks monkeys are quite inferior, not near. And why on earth did they get opposable thumbs when dogs didn't? And so he traces down an entire, in his little sort of naive logic, the Enzo logic, he traces the history of where he believes men evolved from, which is, of course, from dogs. And I think that part of that was, you know, Enzo sometimes comes off as being incredibly profound. And yet at the same time, this is a dog who, you know, he's had very limited, you know, interactions with the world. You know, mm-hmm. It's his family is really what he sees. And he gets a lot of information from television, which we all know is not necessarily reliable. So he's in this situation of trying to piece together this logically. And to him, it makes complete sense. But of course, since we are wise humans, we we see the fallacy of his theory.
And there's one bit where he talks about the... this bit here, I just cracks me up. Let me see if I can find it real quick. It was about when the guy goes behind the tree and comes out as a werewolf.
Yes.
And under the moon. Do you know where that bit is?
I should. Hopefully you have it.
I thought I had marked it, but...
here it is, yes.
It just cracked me up. Would you read that bit, please?
Yes, well, he goes through this whole thing about Darwin, as I said, and then I'll just read his logic. He says, I'll give you a theory. Man's closest relative is not the chimpanzee, as TV people believe, but is, in fact, the dog. Witness my logic. Case in point number one, the dew claw. It is my opinion that the so-called dew claw, which is often snipped off a dog's foreleg at an early age, is actually evidence of a pre-emergent thumb. Further, I believe that men have systematically bred the thumb out of certain lines of dog through an elaborate process called selective breeding, simply in order to prevent dogs from evolving into dexterous, and therefore dangerous, mammals. I also believe that man's continued domestication of dogs is motivated by fear. Fear that dogs left to evolve on their own would in fact develop thumbs and smaller tongues and therefore would be superior to men who are slow and cumbersome, walk standing erect as they do. This is why dogs must live under the constant supervision of people and are immediately put to death when found living on their own. From what Denny has told me about the government and its inner workings, it is my belief that this despicable plan was hatched in a back room of none other than the White House, probably by an evil advisor to a president of questionable moral and intellectual fortitude, and probably with a correct assessment, unfortunately made from a position of paranoia rather than spiritual insight, that all dogs are progressively inclined regarding social issues. Case in point number two, the werewolf. The full moon rises. The fog clings to the lowest branches of the spruce trees. The man steps out of the darkest corner of the forest and finds himself transformed into a monkey? I think not.
I just love it. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My special guest today is Garth Stein. His book is The Art of Racing in the Rain. We'll be right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming Monday, February 16th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, successful author and entrepreneur Omar Tyree. When Omar told people he was a writer, they asked if he had a day job. He's now recognized as one of the most renowned contemporary writers in the literary community. Omar joins Vicky for The Equation, how to take what you love and build it into a successful and financially rewarding life. That's coming Monday, February 9th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Click the shows page on 1150kknw.com for the scoop on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest today is Garth Stein. His latest book is The Art of Racing in the Rain, and it's a New York Times bestseller list. Has been out since last summer, right, Garth?
Yeah, it was out in last May.
Yeah, it's still on the top picks every time I go to the bookstore.
it's just keeps going. As my publisher calls me up on a regular basis and say, this book's got legs. So it's like...
Well, who's Muggs? Talking of legs, who is Muggs? You dedicated the book to Muggs.
Yes, I did. I dedicated the book to Muggs, who was our family dog when I was a kid growing up. And, you know, doing a dedication is often something that someone holds as sort of a personal thing. And you know, I did dedicate it to Muggs, but in a sense, you know, it has to do with my father as well. I remember having a real affection for Muggs when I was a kid growing up. But my father was always sort of the primary, you know, love of Muggs' life. And wherever he was, she wanted to be there. And then, you know, she got older. And when I was I was a teenager. And she got to that point where, you know, her hips had gone. It was very difficult for her. And it was time to take that drive. And I remember my father came home from work early one day, and he was wearing his suit, and he took Muggs and he put her in the back seat of the car. He had to lift her in because she couldn't get in. And he took her off, and he came back without her. And he didn't say a word. He went to the cupboard where she keeps all her stuff, and he took her dog bowl and leashes and everything that she had and put it in a garbage bag and went out and put it up by the garbage cans. And again, he never said a word about it to anyone. But I kind of knew how profoundly it had hurt him.
Right.
So then I decided to dedicate the book to Muggs, and I didn't tell my parents I was going to do it. They had read the manuscript, but they hadn't seen the book. And when you publish a book, there's some fanfare. The publisher, you know, they get all excited. The first book comes off the presses, and it's hot, you know, and they put it in a FedEx container, and they send it to me. I get it the next morning, and it's still hot, right?
Right.
I pull it out, and I'm like, whoa, this is the first book ever printed. And my parents happened to be over. They live in Seattle as well, and they were over looking after my kids. And I said, look, the book is here. And my father took it and he said, oh, it looks lovely. And he opened it up and he saw that I had dedicated it to Muggs and he started to cry.
Oh, bless him.
So I got him.
You got him. Well, I wanted to ask you about your protagonist in the book, Denny, Enzo's master. and why you chose to base him as a racing car driver.
Well, at the time I had been doing, when I started writing it, I'd been doing some race car driving. I grew up in Seattle, went to Sherwood High School, go T-Birds. and I moved to New York and went to college in New York and stayed there for 18 years and moved back to Seattle in 2001 and with my family, my wife and two of my sons. And my father was doing these lapping stuff with Proformance Racing down at Pacific Raceways. And he said, you got to come and do it with me. It's a lot of fun. So I got involved and I ended up getting my competition license and racing a spec Miata for a number of years. And I really enjoyed it. But I also realized that in order to succeed at an endeavor like that, you really have to dedicate everything you have, your effort, all your willpower, all your time, all your energy, all your money. And I wasn't really able to do that. But in participating in that group, I met a lot of really wonderful people. And they talk about things like this. Your car goes where your eyes go. You know, the idea, the philosophies behind driving. Because, you know, you can only do so much with a car. A lot of it has to do with the mental preparation of the driver. And you see that in a lot of sports. You know, ski racing is one that's famous for it, you know, visualization and so forth.
Right, right.
Same thing with race car driving as it is with many, many other sports. And it is a singular focus that we apply. And we kind of like let ourselves do that in our sports and our activities. And that's when I thought, you know, maybe a dog needs to bring this message to the world that we need to do that on all facets of our life. You know, we sometimes spend a lot of time pointing fingers at other people and blaming other people for things. You made me feel, you made me do that, you made me do this. And we don't do that with our dogs, though. We never blame our dogs.
Very true. So, and no matter how ticked off we get with them, they forgive us almost instantly, don't they?
Well, right. And the reason is because they let go of it. You know, they let go of the past immediately and let's just move forward into the future. And yet we as people, we frequently hold grudges. We won't let go. I dare say if with our spouses and our siblings and our children, if we did let go like that, we would have very smooth relationships, no defensiveness, no arguing.
Do you think as the writer, is there a central message in the book for you? I think there's definitely a lot of very nice philosophical viewpoints come across from the dog. But is there a central message there for you?
Well, yeah, there are a couple. I mean, one was just what we were just talking about, mm-hmm. You know, this idea of how we interact with other people and this idea of blame. And it also is about ourselves, how sometimes we blame ourselves too much and we don't give ourselves a break. We base too much of our future actions on things that have gone wrong or things that we're worried about that mm-hmm. have already happened that we can't change. We need to move on a racetrack. It doesn't matter how it happened. It doesn't matter why it happened. It happened. Now, what are you going to do about it? And I think that that's one of the messages of the book. You know, another big message for me is that we have a tremendous amount of power and control over our lives that we often, you know, relinquish. We give up. We were talking about this a little bit earlier. You know, if you're in a job and it really is not pleasurable to you and you get no satisfaction out of it, you need to be responsible to yourself and you need to say, now what am I going to do? How am I going to change this so that my life isn't just about punching a clock, but it's about enjoying myself?
Right, right.
So I think that's something that I wanted to get across in the book.
Yeah, I definitely think it comes across. And the thing I like, it's not preachy. Sometimes that takes art in itself, is delivering a message without making it preachy.
Yeah, I think that I strove for that. I think that's important to, it is fiction and it can be read on a lot of different levels. I had a guy at a reading I did a couple weeks ago stand up and said, I got so much philosophical stuff in your book. Did you intend for that?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, I did, but you get out of it whatever you want to get out of it. If you just want to read it as a straightforward story about Enzo the dog, that's great. If you want to see how maybe that applies to your life and this ideas that he puts across maybe are relevant for you, fantastic. I mean, that's the beauty of writing for me. The reason I love writing and being a writer is that writing is a dialogue. It's not a monologue. I'm not shouting at anyone. I'm putting some stuff out there. There's ideas, there's things. And then the reader interprets it through the own reader's own values, ideas, you know, experiences. The reader has to bring something to the table as well. That's why I really love the communication medium that is fiction.
Yeah. And I read in an interview that you said that you think one of your strengths as a writer is the ability to see the universal towns, people, lives. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, you know, the universal ideas, you know, there are only so many characters, really, if you think about, you know, if you move from anybody who's moved from town to town, there's always certain characters that populate different areas. And I am able to, I think that one of my strengths is to be able to pick those out and utilize them in a particular location. You know, my books are all set in Seattle, or at least partially set in Seattle. I like using this area as a resource, as in a sense a character. So I need to be able to bring whatever characters, these universal characters, into my story in a way that I can incorporate them into the background and into the specific neighborhoods and the things that I like to do.
Now, you've had a very diverse background work-wise. You've also, I just want to read this, that you were born in Los Angeles, raised in Seattle, which you said. You lived for 18 years in New York. Your mother is a native of Alaska. I can't even say what tribe she belongs to. I'm going to let you say. What is it?
Tlingit Indian.
Okay, a Tlingit Indian. And Irish descent. That's interesting. And then your father is a Brooklyn native and a child of Jewish immigrants from Austria.
Yes.
And so how did all this play into making you who you are?
I don't know. It's like a it's like a big stew. It's a big melting pot, my family. What I think is really funny about the history of my parents is my mother's from Alaska, you know, part Tlingit Indian. My father's from New York, and they met in Germany in the army. They were both in the army together in the 1950s. And I think that's kind of a, you know, just the cherry on top. It's like, how else would someone from Alaska, you know, back in those days, you know, someone from Alaska meet someone from New York, but right. In Germany.
In Germany, of course, yeah. Now, this is your third book, and you've also written a play. You've also been heavily involved in documentary film. I actually read that you won an Oscar, but you don't like to dwell on that or don't like to be remembered for that?
It's not so much that I don't like to be remembered for it. I mean, I co-produced a film, a short film called The Lunch Date, back in 1989, that won an Academy Award for live action short. You know, I'm very proud of that. At the same time, it was a film that was made by a very dear friend of mine, Adam Davidson, who's now a TV director down in LA. And, you know, it was really his story. And so, in a sense, my job was to help facilitate his vision. Mm. So, as opposed to something when I write a book, it's all about my vision. So, I guess, you know, I do delineate between, you know, in that regard. And plus, it happened 20 years ago.
Yeah, so. And you've done an awful lot in your career. I think sometimes we put too much emphasis on an award. I was watching the SAG Awards, and Meryl Streep won the Best Actress, and she stood up and said, there is no such thing as the best actress.
Right. Well, I think that's important. And I also think it's important as an artist to continue to push myself. You know, someone in an interview asked me, you know, what's the most... What work that I've done over these years am I most proud of? And, you know, my answer is always the same. The thing I've just finished is the thing I'm most proud of. And if it isn't, then I'm not done with it yet. Then I haven't worked hard enough on it yet. I haven't made it. I should make everything I've just finished the best thing I can possibly do, and I should be the most proud of that.
Mm. Well, you can certainly be proud of this book. I read that, I'm going to read our listeners, the Portland Oregonian said, about the art of racing in the rain. This is one of those stories that may earn its place next to Richard Bach's Jonathan Livingston Seagull, Paulo Coelho's The Alchemist, and Jan Martel's Life of Pi. How does that make you feel?
Well, those are some pretty
big hitters.
Power hitters.
Big hitters.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I am so thrilled with the success that this book has had and the number of people that it's reached and on how many levels it's reached those people. So you know, it just makes me very gratified that a story that I wrote and brought to people is something that people have embraced.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about writing process and what that's like for you. I know every writer has their own kind of routine or process. Do you have a routine? Do you have a daily routine? What's it like for you?
I do. Things have gotten a little complicated with this book because, you know, I've been on the road so much in the past 6 months. Generally, what I do is in the mornings, I do business. I do the business of of book promoting and dealing with New York. Fortunately for me, I'm on the West Coast, and so eventually the people in New York go home and they stop sending me emails. at that time, I like to, when I'm in town, I like to have lunch with my beautiful wife, Drella. And then I go down. I have a little, I rent a desk from Tutabella Pizzeria in Columbia City. And it's the guy, Joe Fougere, who owns it, is the nicest guy. And he has extra space. So he has a few cubicles that he leases out to freelance artists. And I have one of them. And it's just great because I can go there. I have no phone. No one bothers me. I can completely isolate myself. And I spend the afternoons writing. Now, that's generally how I try and structure it. When I'm in the thick of it, in the real thick of it, then I block out mornings and afternoons. Mornings are always revisions. Afternoons are for new material. And then, get at it like that. But
do you outline all of your characters? Do you fully flesh out your characters, or do they evolve as you're writing?
Well, yes, to both. I mean, I have a very big structure guy. I believe in having a story map, and I believe in knowing all my characters, absolutely. And I know the end of the story before I start writing the beginning. It gives me something to aim for. I know all that, also knowing that it could change, and I have to be adaptable to it. I can't have a grip on the steering wheel. I have to have soft hands. So if something new happens or a new character comes in or something changes, I can immediately change where I'm going. I'm not married to it. But if I ever get stuck, I don't get writer's block, because if I'm ever in a tight spot, I just go to my story map and say, well, today I'm going to write this because I have it written here. And even if it's garbage and I throw it away and never use it again, at least I'm writing something. And therefore, I'm going to get through it. If I'm not writing anything, I'm not solving any problems. Mm. So,
I also know that you teach writing. You're actively involved in that. And one of the things that I think it differs a lot with writers, too. For some, it's very easy. For some, it's difficult. And just a couple of fun facts here. Victor Hugo, for example, used to have his servant take away his clothes while he wrote, so that he either wrote in the nude or in his underwear, so that he couldn't go anywhere. And John McPhee wrote in his bathrobe, and he used to tie the arms of his bathrobe to his chair so he couldn't get up and go anywhere. Do you find it a painful process, or do you find it an enjoyable process?
Well, it certainly can be painful. I was reading Murakami's memoir, What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, and he had this really great line in there that I absolutely love, which was, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional.
Mm.
Referring to long-distance running, but I think it applies to a lot of things, including writing, which is, we all have to log our hours, and there's going to be some rough spots on it. Now, if you're just take the pain, if you're going to suffer through it, what is it really helping? It's just diffusing things. So
yeah, suck it up.
Although I like the thing about bathrobes.
Yeah, it was really quite amazing. There's another one who apparently, who was this? Badal Hiram wrote totally in the buff. He said that clothes restricted him, and the sight of him naked was supposedly so repulsive that that no one ever disturbed him.
Oh, that's rich.
So who have been your biggest influences in your work? I mean, you, in film, in books, in theater?
Yeah, it's really hard to say something like that because it always changes, I always say I'm a big fan of Ken Kesey. In fact, I'm rereading Sometimes a Great Notion right now because it applies to a new project that I'm working on. I guess if push comes to shove, I would have to say that my biggest influences came from the theater. Tennessee Williams, Eugene O'Neill, Bertolt Brecht, Sam Shepard, these kinds of...
Sam Shepard's wonderful, yeah.
I mean, there are so... Tom Stoppard. I mean, they're endless. And I was very much into the theater when I was a student. And it taught me a lot about the immediacy of drama. When you're just doing it with dialogue, it happens on the stage, and you have to be able to capture that moment. And I believe in fiction, a fiction writer, at least from my point of view, I believe I have to try and capture that moment. Even though I have the other tools of narrative elements, I still have to capture the immediacy of the drama in order to compel the reader to stay with me.
Yeah, I think probably film helps too, having worked in film, because you're definitely telling that story arc.
Well, yes, and that definitely helps with dramatic structure and so forth, but it also helps with brevity. You know, there's no extra time in film.
Yeah. Ray Bradbury, many creatives say they can't work until the muse strikes mm-hmm. them. Ray Bradbury said that life is the muse, the feeding, everything you do in life feeds your muse. Do you have a take on that?
I guess the question is, who is the muse? What is the muse? And I believe with Ray Bradbury that the muse sometimes is in disguise. You know, when you're a beginning writer, you're often told you have to write every day. You have to write every day. You just have to. And I believe that it is important for a beginning writer to do that because it teaches you the discipline that you're going to have to apply. That being said, this is my third book. I'm now working on my fourth book. I don't have to write every day. Not that I don't have to concentrate every day. I have to focus. I have to concentrate on my story, on my idea. I have to think every day in a focused way about my project. But I don't necessarily have to put words to keyboard every day. So I think that's what Ray Bradbury is getting on about, that, you know, sometimes it's just as valuable for me to go take a very long walk, take Comet to the dog park, play with my kids, because I'll see something or something will trigger something, and then suddenly something's running in my head. And that's what I need. Now, the next day when I wake up, hopefully, if that image is still with me, then I can write about it. But I don't necessarily have to throw everything aside and run to my notebook that instant. I have to develop a trust for myself that my good ideas are going to stick with me and the bad ones are going to, you know, get strained through the colander.
Mm. Who inspires you in your life?
Well, I think that, I mean, I have three young children. One of them not so young anymore. I have a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 20-month-old. And I have my wife. And I think that, you know, it may sound corny and all that, but that's all the inspiration I need in my house. I mean, my wife is just absolutely wonderful, the way she deals with the kids and has such insight into things to prepare our kids for, you know, seeing this world as it evolves and not trying to see it in a fixed way that's, you know, backward looking. She's a very forward looking mm-hmm. person. So I mm-hmm. always get inspiration from that. And then my kids, the way they just like barrel through things, you know, my 12-year-old has become this incredible guitarist. It's like to listen to him play. He's playing Led Zeppelin stuff that I'm thinking, he called me and he's like, have you ever heard this? And, you know, it's All My Love by Led Zeppelin. I was like, dude, I was making out in the back of a Monte Carlo. And that was when that came out in 1979.
But it's so you're fun. Suddenly hip.
Yeah, right. Cycles. So tell me about the cycles, right?
Well, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. I'd like to ask you to read to us again before we go today. Is that
sure,
okay?
Absolutely.
And we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll hear more from Garth Stein. His book is called The Art of Racing in the Rain. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
I'm just walking my dog, singing my song, strolling along. Yeah, it's just me and my dog catching some sun. We can't go wrong. And your doubt, and I don't care what the politicians spout. If you need a companion, why don't you go out to the pound and find yourself a hound and make that dog get proud, cause that's what it's all about.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Coming March 9th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, Dr. Judith Orloff discusses the power of emotional freedom. Imagine yourself running late and stuck in a traffic jam. Instead of getting tense and irritated, you remain peaceful and calm. Or imagine your boss demanding that it's his way or the highway. Instead of feeling intimidated or angry, you feel compassion. A board-certified psychiatrist, Dr. Orloff helps thousands of people transform negative emotions by synthesizing traditional medicine with intuition, energy, and spirituality. Her work has been featured in O Magazine, Self, Cosmo, and she's been a regular on The Today Show, CBS Early Show, and CNN. Tune in Monday, March 9th at noon for The Power of Emotional Freedom on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for guest schedule.
This station is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Good dog.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest is Garth Stein, author, filmmaker, playwright. His new book is called The Art of Racing in the Rain. It's a New York Times bestseller and has been on the top of the charts every time I go into the bookstore since summer. So I'm very pleased to have you here, Garth. And I'd like you're going to read a piece to us right now. Set that up for us, if you would.
Absolutely. There's not much that needs to be said. Enzo is our narrator, and he's a dog. And this scene takes place. I thought it would be fun to read because it takes place up at Denny Creek, which is just a little jaunt up the road from here. Your car goes where your eyes go. We went to Denny Creek, not because it was named after Denny. It wasn't. But because it was such an enjoyable hike. Zoe clumping along in her first pair of waffle stompers. Me cut loose of my leash. Summer in the Cascades is always pleasant, cool under the canopy of cedars and alders, the beaten path packed down, making long strides easy, off the beaten path where dogs prefer, a soft and spongy bed of fallen needles that rot and feed the trees with a steady trickle of nutrients. And the smell. The smell would have given me an erection if I'd still had testicles. Richness and fertility, growth and death and food and decay, waiting, just waiting for someone to smell it, lingering close to the ground in layers, each scent with its own aromatic weight, its own place. A good nose like mine can separate each odor, identify, enjoy. I rarely let myself go, practicing to be restrained like men are. But that summer, considering the joy of all we had, Denny's success and Zoe's exuberance, and even Eve, who was light and free, I ran through those woods that day wildly, like a crazy dog, diving through the bushes, falling over the trees, giving gentle chase to chipmunks, barking at the jays, rolling and scratching my back on the sticks and leaves and needles and earth. We made our way along the path up the hills and down, over the roots and past the rock outcroppings, eventually arriving at the slippery slabs, as they are called, where the creek runs over a series of broad, flat rocks, pooling at some points, streaming at others. Children love the slippery slabs as they slide and slice through the sluices and slate. And so we arrived, and I drank the water cold and fresh, the last of that year's snowmelt. Zoe and Denny and Eve stripped down to their swimsuits and bathed gently in the waters. Zoe was old enough to safely navigate parts herself, and Denny took the lower and Eve took the upper, and they slid Zoe down the stream of water, Eve giving a push and Zoe slipping down. The rocks had traction when dry, but when wet, there was a film on them that made them quite slick. Down she would go, squealing and squirming, splashing into the frigid pool at Denny's feet. He would snatch her up and whisk her back to Eve, who would slide her down again and again. People, like dogs, love repetition. Chasing a ball, lapping a course in a race car, sliding down a slide. Because as much as each incident is similar, so it is different. Denny rushed up the slab and handed off Zoe. He returned to his spot by the pool. Eve lowered Zoe into the water. She screamed and flung herself in play, slid down the slab to be caught by Denny again. Until once. Eve dipped Zoe into the water, but instead of screaming and splashing, Zoe suddenly pulled her toes from the icy water, upsetting Eve's balance. Eve shifted her weight and somehow managed to release Zoe safely onto the dry rock. But her move was too abrupt, too sudden, an overcorrection. Her foot touched the creek, and she didn't realize how slippery those rocks were, slippery slabs like glass. Her legs went out from underneath her. She reached out, but her hand grasped only the air. Her fist closed, empty. Her head hit the rock with a loud crack and bounced. It hit and bounced and hit again like a rubber ball. We stood, it seemed like, for a long time, waiting to see what was going to happen. Eve lay unmoving, and there was Zoe, again the cause, not knowing what to do. She looked at her father, who quickly bounded up to them both. "Are you okay?" Eve blinked hard, painfully. There was blood in her mouth. "I bit my tongue," she said woozily. "How's your head?" Denny asked.
"It hurts."
"Can you make it back to the car?" With me in the lead, herding Zoe, Denny steered Eve. She wasn't staggering, but she was lost, and who knows where she would have ended up if someone hadn't been with her. It was early evening when we got to the hospital in Bellevue. "You probably have a minor concussion," Denny said, "but they should check it out." I'm okay, Eve repeated over and over. But clearly she wasn't okay. She was dazed and slurring her words, and she kept nodding off, but Denny would wake her up saying something about not falling asleep when you have a concussion. They all went inside and left me in the car with the windows open a crack. I settled into the pocket-like passenger seat of Denny's BMW 3.0 CSI, and I forced myself to sleep. When I sleep, I don't feel the need to urinate nearly as badly as when I am awake. Well, it ends with a bodily reference, an Enzo bodily reference.
Okay, we'll skip that bit. But I enjoyed that. Thank you. So they just released the movie Marley and Me about a wayward retriever. What do you think is going to happen with this?
Well, as a matter of fact, I just spent this past weekend at the 24 Hours of Daytona, which is, I guess you would have to say, the second most prestigious endurance automobile race in the world, next to the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And I was there because I was hanging out in the pits with my new best friend, Patrick Dempsey, who's a race car driver himself. Uh-huh. And also, I guess he's somewhat of a movie guy, actor.
Yeah, I think so. You know, he's in that Seattle thing.
Yeah. And Patrick Dempsey has optioned the film rights for this. And he's very excited to make it into a film, and he's going to produce it and very likely play Denny. And he's having spent a 24-hour race with him now, I have to say, he is an absolutely terrific guy, and he really gets the book. He totally gets racing, obviously, being a racer, and he's very excited and enthusiastic, and I hope that, you know, film is a tough world, but I hope that he gets it done.
Yeah, it certainly would be a good film to watch. And I understand you're starting your next book.
I am.
How long does it take you to write a book?
I don't know. Well, my first book took about a year. My second book took about 4 years, and this one took 4 months. So let's see.
Wow.
I hope you throw a dart and we'll see how long. No. I'd like to think that I can write pretty quickly at this point, since I really know the story.
Well, I really appreciate you being with us today. And what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I don't know. I'd like to thank you, Vicky, for having me. You know, I'd like to leave the listeners with this one idea, I guess. Whenever I do a reading, I think it's important that I point out for readers to support independent booksellers and libraries in their communities. I feel it's very important to realize that, you know, these stores add a lot to our communities. That's more than just a place where you can go buy books. They're part of the fabric of the community. And in this economic climate, it's really important for us to, you know, support our locals whenever we can, because it really makes our communities worthwhile.
And we certainly have a lot of independent bookstores here in Seattle, so that's great.
This is the best town for independent bookstores.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. Well, Garth Stein, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Vicky.
Well, a little bird told me before the show that a lot of top-rated TV shows are always worried that writers will make boring interviewees. And that's certainly not the case with Garth Stein. I really enjoyed talking with him and hope you enjoyed him too. You can learn more about Garth Stein and his work at garthstein.com. And I'll spell that for you. It's GARTHSTEIN.com. Or just Google his book, The Art of Racing in the Rain, and it will pop straight up. Coming up next, we're talking about more books, and in particular, we're talking about Book Talk. As some of you know, every week, Conversations Live publishes book reviews via podcast. And I invited Cynthia Baxter, who's my regular contributor on Conversations Live Book Talk podcasts, to be a guest on the show. But she preferred to chat offline with me when we weren't live. So I met her for coffee and we discussed Book Talk, how she selects books, how she goes about writing a review, and some of Cynthia's personal favorites. And here's that conversation now. So Cynthia Baxter, I want to welcome you to the show today.
Thank you.
And the purpose of having you with us today is to talk about Book Talk. And we've introduced that to our listeners. It's our weekly Book Talk podcast book review. Mm-hmm. And so I want to just share a little bit more about you and what you do and why you do this. So let's kick off with an easy one. Tell us when you first fell in love with books.
I was age of four. I started reading back then, and actually just kept on going. By the time I was in kindergarten, I had an eighth grade vocabulary strictly from reading. And I have a part of my degree is in literature, and I am always reading.
So when you let's talk about when you select books to read for personal choice. How do you select books to read for personal choice?
Well, because of book talk and reading fiction, I surprisingly have discovered that I have a guilty pleasure now of reading nonfiction. And I'm drawn to certain stories, and it seems to be something along where I can live vicariously through the characters or the storyline. So, for instance, the nonfiction book that I'm reading right now is called A House in Fez, where a wife and her husband are restoring a house in Morocco. In fiction, it's just, you know, I say this a lot in the podcast, lottery winning, shipwrecks, treasure hunting, all the invisibility, all the fun things. And so those are the kind of books that I am drawn to personally.
Yeah. And you've also done specifically for Book Talk podcast, you've also reviewed some listener requests.
Yes.
And we definitely want to get more listener requests.
I love them. There have been some fantastic requests. Whoever called in or wrote in about Colin Cotterill's Dr. Siri series, I am forever in debt to that person for introducing me to that book. I would not have found it otherwise. It's beneficial for everyone.
Yeah. And we've actually set up, I haven't even told you this yet, but I told our listeners a couple of weeks ago, I've actually set up a special listener voicemail box so that people can call in, because not everybody is, you know, has email.
Right.
It's hard to believe, but not everybody has email today. So we do have a listener voicemail box, and it's 206-414-6159. And I'll give that out again in a minute. But, you know, if anybody listening today has ideas or a book that you would just love Cynthia to review, please email us at info@conversationslive.net. Or use that voicemail box, which is 206-414-6159. And just leave your suggestion. Great if you leave your name and contact info, but if you don't want to do that, do it anonymously. That's fine with us.
Yeah.
We just want to get some input. So I mentioned on a show once, because I've been to your house and seen your library, and I mentioned once that you were seriously having to check the load bearing on your room.
Yes.
Tell us how many books you have.
I'm at 2,500 books right now.
2,500. And you log them into a database, right?
Yes, yes. I use a book collector, and I have a little barcode, and I zap the, if it has a barcode or an ISBN number, I'll log that in or zap it with the barcode reader, and it goes right in. It's a wonderful database, and I've had absolutely zero problems with it, and it logs everything. I mean, everything, including the summary of the book, and downloads the front cover and lets me know I have five of them. And
so tell me why you like writing reviews of books, because it's very different actually writing a review than actually, you know, just reading for the sake of reading.
It is.
Pleasure.
It is. I think it kind of forces you into reading it more critically. When you know that you're going, that there's an expectation of you to voice about the book that you're reading, you tend to take a little bit more attention to what you're doing and how your reaction to it is. When I read, I keep a post-it notepad on my chest because I read reclining.
Of course, doesn't everyone?
And I'll have a pen or a pencil and this post-it note, and whenever I find something, I write it and stick it on the page, and you can get quite a fanning of post-it notes on the top of these books. And I don't lose my place. So when it comes back to writing, I just kind of flip through and get the general feeling of my book as I'm reading it. And I think you can kind of see that in the podcast, that I try to give you kind of my guttural personal response to the book. To me, that's a little bit more important than finding out, you know, how the plot ended. I don't want to ruin anything for anybody. But I think people like to hear how I liked it and my response to it, or my family's, as a result of me getting inspired into cooking or whatever. I do get into these books. They're my means of escape.
I was going to ask you that. Do you read as a means of escape? Because a lot of people read for different reasons. And I know that there is growth from that because you learn about faraway places and different cultures and different ways of living and being.
Exactly. And if you'll notice, there's a high percentage of the books that I read are from foreign authors. And there's a little thing about that. About 100% of what we publish is exported, but very, very little of what the world writes is imported. And I like to kind of explore what the world has to offer, literally. And I think it's important to discover people beyond our borders and find out about their society's culture through their literature. I think that's very important. Mm. So that's probably the main reason why there's so many foreign authors in my reading list.
What excites you about a book?
I like when an author does not make me feel like a complete idiot and spoon feeds me the storyline. And I'll refer to this, one of my Baxter-isms is I call it eye rolling, and that usually translates into, oh God, give me a break. And, and it's just, don't beat me upside the head with this. I like intelligent writing. I like the fact that they give me the opportunity to figure it out. Alice Munro is one of the things that she was able to do in her short stories is to tell a story by not telling it. It's all the things that were unsaid that filled in this short, very short story, 20, 30 pages or whatever, and it's all these unsaid things. So that's important.
So, you know, Cynthia, I told listeners that we were going to have a cup of coffee and talk about this, but Cynthia, we're actually drinking wine. We're sitting on the floor in my studio having a glass of wine. So tell us a little about some of your favorite books. Do you have an all-time favorite? Do you have an all-time favorite author?
I have, well, my favorite all-time author is L. Frank Baum. I have not only every book he's written, but several versions and editions of the same book. And of course, he's best known for the Oz books, Wizard of Oz, and so on and so forth. And so I love L. Frank Baum. Carl Hiaasen, Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman, those kind of guides I really like. I like fun reading. I don't think that we laugh enough. So finding fun books is certainly up there. Christopher Moore is another one. However, when I hear the words Life of Pi by Jan Martel, I have that held in a special place. I'm not alone, but in liking Life of Pi, and they're actually going to make a movie of that. But as I said earlier, there's either you either love it or you hate it, and there just doesn't seem to be a gray area with Life of Pi. And there is one part that seems to be very thin where people were lost on it, but altogether I think it was a genius book. Unfortunately, you can't read it more than once. It's like seeing The Sixth Sense more than once. You already know. So that's the problem with Life of Pi, but for some reason that seems to remain in my high list. Thousand Splendid Suns is another high on my list book of good books. Everyone liked The Kite Runner, but I think my response was more guttural with A Thousand Splendid Suns. And I followed that with Lottery, which I did do a podcast on, and I practically put myself in therapy after that. So,
all right. Well, we won't ask why. I really appreciate you being with us today, and we're going to have to get together and chat some more so listeners get to know more about you and what you do. And I guess meantime, I'm going to ask you to sign off the way you usually do. So let's raise our glasses and have a little chink.
Enjoy the book.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
If you haven't checked out our podcasts, you can find them at 1150kknw.com. Scroll down the homepage to podcasting. And Book Talk is on the bottom right corner of the podcasting page, 1150kknw.com. And you can also link directly there from my website at conversationslive.net. And we'd love for you to make book suggestions for us to review. Several of the books already reviewed were by listener request, And I've set up a special listener voicemail box where you can leave a book suggestion, or you maybe you even want to write a book review. Perfectly welcome to do that. So if you do that, just give me a call and we'll talk about it and get you on our podcast series. You can leave any feedback on our shows or suggest potential topics or guests for upcoming shows at our listener voicemail box. And I'm going to give you a couple of numbers. The listener voicemail number is 206-414-6159. That's 206-414-6159. And if you want to receive a call back, please remember, leave a name and number so we can get hold of you. And you can also reach me at our 800 number, 495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or via email at info@conversationslive.net. I will be back next week with guests Omar Tariq and Mary Kay Plantis. Until then, live well, live strong, and thank you so much for spending this hour with me on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Coming Monday, February 16th on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, successful author and entrepreneur Omar Tariq. When Omar told people he was a writer, they asked if he had a day job. He's now recognized as one of the most renowned contemporary writers in the literary community. Omar joins Vicky for The Equation, how to take what you love and build it into a successful and financially rewarding life. That's coming Monday, February 9th at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.